My name is Ren Tawil. You're listening to the Mideast Migraine Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz. I do hope that lovely Eastern Mediterranean music made you feel comfortable and mellowed you out. because I am about to unmellow you. And again, my name is Ren Tweel. This is the Mideast Migraine Show. For Monday, April 14, in the year 2014, the time is 3:07 Pacific Daylight Time here on the west coast of North America. If 3:07 on April 14th jives with your personal time-space continuum, you know that the show is live and you are invited to call in directly to the studio. I will answer the phone. Area code 831-427-3772. Again, for those who already have the writing implements made available or handy, area 831-427-3772. We're all bombarded through various avenues just about every day with requests for money, donations, your truly appreciated financial support. No, I'm not about to ask you for any such donation, at least not right now. I'm going to start the show with a bit of a bang here. Here's an example of one we got in our personal postal mail from the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews. Featuring on the envelope, black and white picture, rather stark picture, of an elderly woman with a babushka, or whatever the proper, probably Hebrew pronunciation is for it, a sheer fabric head covering. She has a certain faraway look in her eye, and her hands are enclosed in a prayerful pose. Little old lady with large letters, again, this is on the front of the envelope before you even open it, saying, "You can feed an elderly Jewish widow in Israel for only $2.40. An important message from Christian leaders." So, we have the very hard to ignore and dismiss picture of the apparently shattered life of an elderly Jewish lady on the cover. I'll begin reading this letter. I won't subject you to the entire thing. Incidentally, they're right on the top in what appears to be scribbled on writing. "Please read how Christians like you are helping rescue the poor in Israel." The poor in Israel, signed Rabbi Eckstein. March 17, "Dear Christian friend," and I don't even know how they know that I'm Christian. This may or may not be a guess on their part. "But dear Christian friend, every morning, 71-year-old Haya makes her way out of her little apartment in Israel and heads down a cracked asphalt path. She walks slowly and carefully down a route she has painstakingly memorized. Sometimes she falls, but she gets up, dusts herself off, and continues on her way. You see, Haya is blind, destitute, and struggling to survive on her own. She receives a meager monthly pension, but there's never enough money to buy adequate food." In bold letters here, "My name is Yechiel Eckstein. I'm an Orthodox rabbi who's been working with thousands of Christians across America to help rescue Jews. Folks, to help rescue Jews and fulfill biblical prophecy. Since the walls of communism fell in 1990, the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews has helped over 300,000 Jews escape oppression and persecution and flown them to freedom in Israel." It goes on, "I'm sure it will come as a shock to know that thousands of elderly people in Israel like Hai are hungry and desperate today. Coming to the promised land fulfilled a lifetime dream for these survivors. But the dream has been shattered by the nightmare of life in Israel today. The nightmare of life in Israel, folks. Suicide bombers have killed and crippled thousands. Resources have been drained. The government can no longer care for the old and feeble. And they are once again at risk. Blah, blah, blah. I'm not going to try to tell anyone out there that there are not Jewish, elderly, or otherwise citizens of Israel who are subjected to some of the grief that's described in this letter, asking for our help, and I'll outline that in a little bit. But here is one of a number of apparently unified efforts, unified between Christian and Jew, efforts to once again save the Jews, to recognize the importance of working together, and this is all in the Judeo-Christian spirit of giving and reconciliation and alms to the poor and sharing what we who have it so much better off, forgive my English, what we have to those who are in more dire need, to those who are in dire need. I read descriptions very similar to this all the time through my various sources of those natives of the land of Israel, which is also called Palestine. It has been called Palestine actually in namological terms, lexicographical terms. It's been called Palestine longer than it's been called Israel, which is to say it was the land of the Philistines. The word Palestine is based on that name. Before it was the land of the Jews. But that's really not that important. Instead of getting into this long thing about who really deserves to be there more, if there is such a thing, I am still quite perturbed at hearing such descriptions applied to little old blind Jewish ladies, as real as they may be, and at the same time, they're drawing attention away, whether they intend to or not. I personally think they are. This is part of that effort. Drawing attention away from the native Palestinian Arabs, particularly those who are not citizens of Israel and do not enjoy the political, civil, or human rights, which supposedly are offered all Israeli citizens, whether they're Jewish or whether they're not Jewish. Namely, the Palestinian Arabs under occupation in the West Bank, which is being encroached upon by illegal Jewish settlement, aided and abetted and encouraged by the government of the State of Israel, illegal settlements in what's left of what's supposed to be free Palestine. The Arabs who live there are not Jews, and they are not citizens of the State of Israel. They're under military occupation. The occupation itself, the ongoing character of it, is considered illegal under international law for good reason, not the least of which is how it tends to very much encourages tacitly and actively and encourages more settlement by outlanders, which is to say Jews, whether they come immediately from the State of Israel or from elsewhere in the world, the settlements are populated by Jewish people in a land illegally occupied by the military, and the settlements themselves are illegal. And all this stuff about every morning 71-year-old so-and-so makes her or his way out of their little apartment and heads down a cracked asphalt path. In the West Bank, the people are lucky if they have any streets made out of any maintained and well-kept asphalt at all. They are digging at your heartstrings here. She walks slowly and carefully down a route she has painstakingly memorized. Sometimes she falls, but in the strictest pull yourself up by your bootstraps, American tradition, she gets up, picks herself up, dusts herself off, and continues on her way. She's blind, destitute, and struggling to survive on her own. Yes, I've heard these descriptions applied to the Palestinians, who suffer far more than a short, sightless walk down to wherever they're going and back again. Some of them, and this happens with more regularity than almost anyone realizes, they're picked off by snipers, including little children walking to and from school. This is documented fact. Even the Israeli so-called defense forces document this stuff. They may leave a lot of stuff out, but their own military, the Israeli military, can admit to you that these things go on. I'm just giving you a sampling of how this really sickening piece of postal mail, a beseechment of your funds, which hopefully will go directly to these people, and it's possible that a goodly amount of it does not go, they could very easily just be talking about replace the names. Instead of an Israeli woman or a woman with an apartment in Israel, they can say Palestinian Arab, who have apartments or the remnants of a poorly maintained, due to lack of funds, due to lack of public assistance, home in the West Bank or in the Gaza Strip. And, of course, this guy talks about the dangers, the nightmare of life in Israel for the Jews. Suicide bombers have killed and crippled thousands. Of course, they're not telling you that it is virtually impossible for suicide bombers to strike anymore, thanks to the apartheid wall that was erected. And this apartheid so-called security wall slash fence has, in its very existence, in the fact that it has been physically erected, ruins the lives of Palestinians because it slices and dices what little is left of the continuity of their community in the West Bank. The wall itself runs through the properties, often separating farmhouse from field, through the middle of villages, Palestinian villages, Arab non-Jewish villages in the West Bank, all for the in an effort to keep the suicide bombers out of Israel. I'm all for that. I am also for improving the lives, or at least letting the Palestinians improve their own lives with open commerce and far more open borders than they have had for the past 46 years. If you want security, you don't lock them up like animals in a zoo, which is the way many Israelis apparently prefer to view the Arabs, as savage animals that have to be caged up. And that will contribute significantly to the reduction of the suicide bombings. Suicide bombings did not even become a factor until a couple of decades after the Arabs lost what little sovereignty they had over the West Bank and the Gaza Strip to the Israelis when Israel invaded them. Actually, the Palestinians had a lot more freedom under Jordanian and Egyptian rule, respectively, before 67. It was far from perfect, but at least they had something of an economically viable life and more freedoms. It is indeed the Palestinian Arabs who are shackled from a normal life by the utterly ubiquitous presence of Israeli troops, jackbooted thugs. You can tell by looking at the pictures of them everywhere in the West Bank. Occupation troops, hundreds and hundreds of checkpoints, and the soldiers who man these checkpoints can tell you that there's that there will never be enough of them if they really want to completely restrain the movement of the Palestinians and do everything that is feasibly possible to prevent attacks on Israel. Again, attacks that are born out of frustration and the miserable conditions of a semi-life imposed on them by their occupiers. It is truly stomach-turning when I read about the supposed nightmare of life in Israel today. You know what life is like today for Jews in Israel? Palestinian Arabs rarely come to mind at all because they have garrisoned themselves off in every approachable, conceivable way from those that their soldiers occupy. They don't even feel that there's anyone worth talking to towards a peace process. The Israeli Jews simply live their lives in their Jewish state, where one out of every five people is not a Jew, but supposedly a full-fledged citizen. That is a myth. All benefits of the Israeli democracy are not fully shared by everyone, be they non-Jew or Jew. Suicide bombers have killed and crippled thousands. That is not anywhere close to the number of Palestinians who have been killed by Israelis, according to a variety of documented sources. Resources have been drained, the rabbi said. Rabbi Eckstein says here. The Palestinians who live in the West Bank have almost no resources to begin with. Almost none offered them by the Israeli government compared to the few that they get from NGOs, non-governmental organizations, from outside that part, that immediate part of the world. And apparently they're getting harder and harder to come by those. Israel restricts the flow of even non-Israeli sourced goods and services and assistance. Palestinian resources indeed are drained, but they're only, Rabbi Eckstein is only referring to the resources that supposedly the Israeli government can no longer offer its own elderly and infirm Jewish population. They pour so much money and energy into the occupation of land that they are actively involved in swallowing up for more Jewish settlements. Those resources, instead of used to take away land, to continue to steal land from Palestine, could be turned to their own elderly Jewish citizens. The government can no longer care for the old and feeble, it says here, and they are once again at risk. You can only blame Israel for that, as far as I'm concerned. And so, the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews, as it claims to be here, is turning to the good Christian like me, to whom they sent the letter, to the missus and me at home, and they are asking for our help far and away above the $3.2 billion that the American taxpayer, is already paying, and all of that, 100% of that, goes into the Israeli military. Again, to repress and wreck the economy of Palestinian Arabs, to make way for more Jewish residences, illegal as they are under international law. But they want us, the individual donors, to pay even more. Another sentence from this sickening letter. While most of the world has turned its back on Israel and the Jews, I know that Christians in America have not forgotten them. I believe God will bless you for your support of the Israeli people, for as He, with a capital H, God promised Abraham, I will bless those who bless you. Genesis 12, chapter 3, verse. That's right. Invoke Holy Scripture, invoke that old covenant, that Old Testament, which is revered by Christian and Jew alike, to find the common ground to not turn your back on Israel and Jews. And this is another evocation of how the world ignored the Jews, how the Catholic Church and the Pope in particular were criminal and complicit in the Nazi Holocaust for not stepping in as certain Jewish authorities would have preferred that they do to hopefully prevent the Holocaust. As horrible as it was, while most of the world has turned its back on Israel and the Jews, that kind of mentality is invoked all too often, and it is sickeningly hypocritical. And of course, they appeal to my inherent American Christianity-ness, my inherent Christianness, as having not forgotten about them. These settlers, Jewish settlers, in the land that they stole, and that their government and their military stole from the Arabs, the Palestinian Arabs, have swimming pools, have all the water that they want in these new, very modern condominium or townhouse-like settlements in the West Bank, in the hills, in the valleys of the West Bank, usually on the hills so they can overlook the downtrodden vermin, as it were, of the Palestinian pestilence there. They have all the water they need and can use, probably more. The Palestinians are very lucky to get any clean water, even in East Jerusalem. The government of Israel gives priority to its own Jewish residents over non-Jewish residents, and therefore the plumbing, the infrastructure, and the source of clean water for East Jerusalem's native Arab Palestinians often is not available. They are strapped for water, as I read in a report from USA Today a week ago on this program. Even clean water just to drink, let alone bathing and washing clothes. Sometimes the Arabs there have to send their dirty laundry across town to neighbors and friends they may know who may have better luck turning their taps on or off. And on top of all this, on top of this terrible disparity of a most basic human requirement for life and living decently, on top of that, Israelis pay about half as many shekels per liter of water through their public utilities than the Palestinians do. Palestinians pay twice as much and they get far, far less. Well, Rabbi Eckstein, you will hear from me, sir, blessed holy rabbi, who says he is the founder and president of International Fellowship of Christians and Jews. You will hear from me, but it won't be a check or a money order you'll receive. I'm going to return in the prepaid envelope a little note telling you what I think of you and your utterly hypocritical and divisive request for donations. They even have a picture of the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, picture of his lovely smiling face with the quotation, We deeply appreciate Rabbi Eckstein's dedication and consistent support and commend his outstanding efforts. I salute the supporters of the fellowship whose efforts and dedication have helped it flourish. Oh, if Bibi himself stands by these people, they must be blessed by God, right? There are, as I mentioned earlier, some pre-written in amounts of, say, $17 will provide a week of nutritious meals for an elderly Jew in Israel. $34 will provide a week of nutritious meals for two elderly Jews. Your gift of $51 for three Jews. And then, of course, the ever-present dollar sign with a blank space. for you to fill in and provide nutritious meals for as many elderly Jews in Israel as possible. And on the back of each one of those sort of coupon clip-outs, here are the chosen quotations from Scripture. Psalm 41, the first verse, "Blessed is he who has regard for the weak." Psalm 107:9, "He satisfies the thirsty and fills the hungry with good things." Joel chapter 2, verse 26, "You will have plenty to eat, and you will praise the name of the Lord your God." Proverbs 19, chapter 17th verse, "He who is kind to the poor lends to the Lord." Apparently, those, of course, are all passages from the Christian Old Testament or the Jewish Talmud or Torah, the Torah anyway. He who is kind to the poor lends to the Lord, particularly if the people you were giving to were Jewish, but maybe not if they're Palestinian Arabs. Okay, I really needed to take advantage of the fact that they are beseeching me for money. They even send I don't think I've ever seen a certificate of this size before, all folded up, of course, with the creases still in it, so it fits into the envelope. Most of it written in Hebrew, but clearly it is from the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews. English translation of the Hebrew above it. "May you be forever blessed with food, drink, and rest for your body, and laughter, hope, and love for your soul. Peace and blessings from your friend in America." And then you sign this, and then I guess you put it on your wall. Rabbi Eckstein's going to hear from me. Just in case any of those gazillions of you out there who listen to this show twice a week receive the same mailing, you now have my take on it. Okay, this is the Mideast Migraine Show with your host, Ren Tawil. Brought to you by Free Radio Santa Cruz. 101.3 FM streaming live at freakradio.org. Don't forget to click on that red oval for the streaming link. 3:34, 1,534 hours Pacific Daylight Time. Okay, you got your pen and paper finally ready? Area code, direct to the studio here, so you could talk at me. Area 831-427-3772. Again, area 831-427-3772. See what's going on here. Okay, it's good to know we have a few more listeners out there. The ever-present listeners. Okay. Let's get on with the show, stepping briefly away from the madness of the Holy Land. As diametrically sounding as that may be, from the United Nations News Center, April 11, that would be last Friday, marking UN Space Day, online astronaut encourages exploration. Quote, "Always carry duct tape." This is a dispatch from the UN News Center. "The necessity for international cooperation in space and the universal utility of duct tape were among insights revealed when the United Nations sent a former astronaut into cyberspace today to inspire young people to explore new frontiers on the anniversary of the first human spaceflight." Tako Doi, that's spelling here is first name, T-A-K-A-O, Doi, D-O-I, Tako Doi, an expert on space applications with the United Nations Office for Outer Space Affairs, who was an astronaut prior to joining the World Organization, conducted a chatter twit, chatter twit. Let's turn that around. Conducted a Twitter chat to answer questions about his experience ahead of the International Day of Human Spaceflight celebrated on 12 April. That would have been Saturday. The chatter twit. On that day in 1961, referring to the anniversary of the first human space flight, 1961, Yuri Gagarin of the Soviet Union became the first human to go into space. 50 years later, the United Nations General Assembly declared the International Day of Human Spaceflight to mark the new era that had dawned and to encourage peaceful uses of outer space that would benefit all people. Mr. Doi flew in the space shuttles Columbia and Endeavour. That would be the late shuttle Columbia. Well, they're all late, considering none of them are online anymore, the surviving ones. And he flew in 1997 and 2008, respectively. Columbia, then the Endeavour. Undertaking a spacewalk in the first mission and visiting the International Space Station in the second. Answering questions in today's Twitter chat. He compared the experience of walking in space to swimming in a scuba suit and said that the space station was much larger than people imagined. Quote, as big as a football field, lots of live and work... lots of living and workspace. End quote. Asked if duct tape was ever used to temporarily repair equipment in space, Mr. Doi wrote, all the time, duct tape is an astronaut's best friend. Carry it everywhere. And a bunch of cyber dribble here. Continuing, he told a questioner from a developing country that everyone's contributions are needed to make advances in outer space that would benefit humankind. Quote, no one country has all innovative ideas. Need international cooperation, he tweeted. So the contributions he's referring to are not like those that Rabbi Eckstein asks for in the mass mailing. Not money, or not only money, but the contributions of your education and your applied creativity. Continuing with Mr. Doi's continued quotation, the exploration of outer space is a truly global undertaking, and I hope that the International Day of Human Spaceflight will inspire young people, in particular, to strive towards new frontiers of knowledge and understanding. Said, oh no, it wasn't the astronaut who said that. That's a quotation from the new director of UNUSA, Simonetta DiPippo, said in her video at such and such an address. Of course, UNUSA stands for, as I mentioned earlier, the UN Office for Outer Space Affairs. Just go to www.unosa.org, UNUSA, the UN Office for Outer Space Affairs. And there's more to this dispatch. Also, to celebrate the day, UNUSA, which is based at UN headquarters in Vienna, Austria, in Europe, has launched its third edition of the online autograph album, Messages from Space Explorers for Future Generations, which features notes from international astronauts in English, French, and Russian. The present edition contains 57 messages from astronauts of 20 countries, including from the first woman in space. That would have been Valentina Tereshkova. Never could forget that name. Valentina Tereshkova, the first Chinese woman in space and the pilot of the Apollo 16 lunar module, and is available at the UNUSA website. For more details, go to the UN News Center at www.un.org/news. That's .un.org/NEWS, UNORG News. Yeah, those of the gazillions of you who hear this program twice a week will know that I do enjoy reading dispatches from the United Nations. Now getting back to the good stuff. Israelis and Arabs. Israelis and Palestinians and Jews and Muslims and Christians and all the others. From Jewish Voice for Peace, a courageous organization unafraid to tout and push its agenda of solidarity with the Palestinian Arabs, sends this to us. Jewish Voice for Peace. It simply says in the title, POOF, P-O-O-F, POOF, News and Analysis, quote, 700 settlement units were announced in Jerusalem, and poof, that was sort of the moment, end quote. From Secretary of State John Kerry, the U.S.-backed peace process is faltering. What comes next? A picture with a rather subdued, down to the bottom of the photograph, John Kerry covering his forehead and eyes with his hand in some obscure demonstration of resignation. It's captioned, Kerry's last statement, more honest than he intended, namely when he said, poof, that was sort of the moment, in reference to 700 Jewish settlements, new Jewish settlements to be built, were announced in Jerusalem. Dear Wren, it wasn't exactly poetry, but Secretary of State John Kerry's testimony to Congress this week might go down in history as a real turning point in the last 20 plus years of U.S. orchestrated negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians. For the first time, and despite later efforts to backtrack, a U.S. Secretary of State admitted it was the Israelis who are derailing talks. All bold letters here, not capitals, but all bold letters. Emphasis. Kerry couldn't have been made more clear about the recent sequence of events that have driven these talks to the brink. Kerry couldn't have been more clear about the recent sequence of events that have driven these talks to the brink. First, Israel refused to release the last group of Palestinian prisoners they had promised to free. Then they announced construction of 700 new settlement units. And only then did the Palestinians announce that they would attempt to join 15 international human rights conventions. The word convention here, by the way, as I interrupt this dispatch, doesn't exactly refer to a big rah-rah get-together, a junket for say, a politician, like a convention you hold at a hotel and ballroom. It's, the International Human Rights Conventions is a way of expressing a united document to which various members or member nations subscribe. So, well, let me just read you that paragraph again. Very significant, the order in which these things have happened. First, Israel refused to release the last group of Palestinian prisoners they had promised to free. Then they, the Israelis, announced construction of 700 new settlement units on top of the many thousands they have already not only built, but recently announced that they would build. And only then did the Palestinians announce that they would attempt to join 15 international human rights conventions. Continuing with this dispatch, the U.S. and Israel still vigorously criticized that move of the Palestinians to join the conventions, which begs the question, what kind of quote-unquote peace process considers signing on to covenants promoting the rights of children, the disabled, and others a threat to peace? What kind of peace process considers signing on to covenants promoting the rights of children and the disabled and others a threat to peace? Of course, unilateral Israeli actions to undermine peace go back much further. again with the bold letters, since the Oslo Accords, going back over 20 years ago, since the Oslo Accords, the number of Jewish settlers on Palestinian land has more than doubled to more than 650,000. In fact, Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, campaigned for re-election on a promise of 1 million Jews living in, quote-unquote, Judea and Samaria. That is the preferred Hebrew label for the West Bank, Judea and Samaria, which has nothing to do with the presence, the 20th and 21st century conditions of the West Bank of Palestine, other than the artificial influx of Jewish settlers there. Continuing with this dispatch from JVP, rather than hold Israel accountable, the United States has repeatedly rewarded the Israeli government whenever it violated the law or violated agreements, now fueling the occupation with $3.2 billion in annual military aid. The United States is indeed acting like a broker in these talks, representing Israel. The losers in this peace scam, the Palestinians most of all, but also every Israeli who wants lasting and just peace. And every U.S. resident who wants our tax money to be used for freedom and democracy, not occupation and apartheid. Bold letters again. In truth, the terms carry in Israel set forth have nothing to do with equality. They'll require Palestinians to sit at the back of the bus. But they give us an idea of what will be on the table should talks, which have proven to be an effective delaying tactic while Israel builds, quote, facts on the ground, limp along. I'll read that again because it's kind of a long, clumsy sentence. But they give us an idea of what will be on the table should talks limp along. And those talks have proven to be an effective delaying tactic while Israel builds its own preferred facts on the ground. Continuing, they include an unprecedented demand that the Palestinian Authority recognize Israel as a Jewish state. That's code for condemning Israel's 25% of citizens. So they say not 1 in 5, but 1 in 4. 25% of citizens who aren't Jewish to second and third class status and denying the internationally recognized rights of Palestinian refugees. And the land being negotiated for a future Palestinian, quote, state, end quote. It looks more like the holes in a piece of Swiss cheese thanks to decades of U.S.-enabled settlement expansion. Put another way, whatever the rhetoric of a quote-unquote two-state solution, Israeli policies have already created a de facto single state, including all of Israel, the West Bank, Gaza, and considered occupied by international law, East Jerusalem, albeit one built on the promise of separate and unequal lives for Jews and non-Jews. This is the very definition of apartheid. So what next? At Jewish Voice for Peace, we believe that the struggle for freedom and self-determination will end, like similar struggles in Northern Ireland and South Africa, at the negotiation table. But that will only happen when all parties can sit down together with equal power. I verbally highlighted that last sentence. They put it in italics. But that will only happen when all parties can sit down together with equal power. Israel has one of the strongest militaries in the world, sixth largest, I believe. It is the only nuclear arsenal in the Middle East, and the unconditional backing of the world's sole superpower. It is the 24th wealthiest country in the world. I'll say that again. The Jewish state of Israel, the recognized country, nation, state of Israel, is the 24th wealthiest country in the world, which gets $3.2 billion every year for at least the next 6 or 7 years, based on one of those budgetary options stated 4 or 5 years ago, will continue to receive year after year for 10 years hence. Of the United States foreign aid budget, more than any other country on that budgetary scale in the world, they're at number one, the 24th wealthiest country in the world. Meanwhile, the Palestinians across the table remain stateless, impoverished, occupied, or second-class citizens inside of Israel. But the balance of power is changing, it says here. And the engine of that change is the unstoppable movement of nonviolent resistance by Palestinians and their allies, including Jews of conscience, around the globe. Education, lobbying, the involvement of international legal bodies, demonstrations in the streets in Israel and Palestine have all made a difference and will continue to grow. And where our governments have thus far failed us, more and more people everywhere have begun to stand up and use nonviolent economic power to build pressure on Israel to do the right thing. The successes of the Palestinian-led nonviolent movement for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, good old BDS, are growing. The successes are growing, with billions of dollars in major multinational corporations already impacted. That pressure has already been felt at this round of talks. Even Prime Minister Netanyahu mentioned BDS 26 times in his speech to AIPAC. AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, the largest U.S. pro-Israel lobbying organization. In italics, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement is the Palestinians' Montgomery bus boycott. This movement for us as Jews is a form of Tochecha. Tochecha, the Jewish tradition of sacred rebuke, which comes from a place of love and is the religious obligation to remind one's friends to live by their values. It is also a nonviolent and principled way to liberate our community from the dehumanizing role of an oppressor. Can BDS really work? We think so. Israeli government officials agree. Israeli Finance Minister Yair Lapid warned that even a limited European Union boycott could cost the Israeli economy over $5 billion a year. Here they're getting $3.2 from the American taxpayer per year. Finance Minister Lapid suggests that they may lose more than $5 billion a year, almost twice what they're getting in American taxpayer aid. Foreign Minister Zvi Livni put it even more directly, quote, "The boycott is moving and advancing uniformly and exponentially. Those who don't want to see it will end up feeling it," end quote. Already impacted, even Israel's business elites are organizing to demand a negotiated agreement, referring to with the Palestinians, of course. Certainly BDS is working better than any strategy has before. It's a movement rooted in Palestinian civil society, women's groups, trade unions, students. And so it has no leader that can be stopped, no single funder that can be cut off. It is fueled instead by the same love for justice, equality, and human rights that has fueled every successful justice movement the world has ever seen. Grounded in international law, it seeks an end to occupation, equality for the Palestinian citizens of Israel, and a just resolution for millions of refugees. But why BDS to get to the negotiating table? Martin Luther King famously wrote in his letter from a Birmingham jail the following, quote, this is MLK speaking, or writing in this case, quote, "You may well ask, why direct action? Why sit-ins, marches, and so forth? Isn't negotiation a better path? You are quite right in calling for negotiation. Indeed, this is the very purpose of direct action. Nonviolent direct action seeks to create such a crisis and foster such a tension that a community which has constantly refused to negotiate is forced to confront the issue," end quote. That is precisely what we are doing, says this dispatch from the Jewish Voice for Peace, and goes on to say, "And we ask you to continue to join us in this historic movement, so that all who live in Israel and Palestine, in whatever configuration both peoples choose, can live as equals, with the same opportunities to raise families safely, go to school, and build a future. Whatever happens in the coming days and weeks, we have turned a corner, and there's no going back. Sincerely, Cecily Shurasky, Deputy Director of JVP." And, of course, they, too, are asking for donations. P.S. We believe the end of talks will lead to an even greater blossoming of activism. Can you make sure we have the power we need with an $18 donation today? I happen to be a current annual donor to JVP. So, this is a rather flowery and, I think, very informative request for money. First, talking about the utter, what I see in my mind is the utter pointlessness of even trying to pursue real sit-down negotiations with the Israelis. They've reneged on a lot of things, not just this business about Israel refusing to release the last group of Palestinian prisoners, tens of them, I believe some three or four score Palestinian prisoners. They've reneged on ceasefire agreements in the Gaza Strip and in the West Bank. They have promised compliance with accords along the lines of the Oslo process that they reneged on. People say it's almost proverbial to say, well, you can't trust an Arab. You just can't trust the Arabs. The Israelis have certainly done their share of lying and reneging and just lying some more, turning their backs on previous agreements because they can get away with it. They have the power. The emphasis for the Israelis is more expansion of Jewish settlements into Palestinian land, whether there are negotiations or not. And indeed, they have stipulated in any negotiations and during past negotiations with Yasser Arafat and Mahmoud Abbas that Israel should have the right to keep and fully incorporate certain blocks, hundreds and hundreds of acres of blocks of Jewish settlements as part of the supposedly negotiated outcome. And I really appreciate the fact that JVP here, Jewish Voice for Peace, by no means to be confused with the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews, whose bogus message I read at the beginning of today's program. JVP emphasizes, and rightly so, and in my opinion should have started to emphasize this a lot earlier in their career, how BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, is not only a call for boycott, an academic and educational boycott of Israel until Israel starts acting right and granting and maintaining human rights for the Palestinians. Not only is that what BDS is about, BDS is also entirely a nonviolent movement. I appreciate their mentioning this because going back to my very young days, when I was still a minor, legal minor, in California here, you kept hearing about how Palestinians or Arabs, whatever you prefer to call them, initially were nothing but refugees, and then they became nothing but refugees and bloodthirsty terrorist killers. Long ago, decades ago, the term terrorist and terrorism was applied to the Arabs, and Israeli and American Jewish propaganda made that label stick. Terrorists, 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 all of them. Couching and firmly entrenching in the American taxpayer mind that all supposedly all the Palestinians want to do is kill off all the Jews, drive them to the sea, and reclaim the land of Israel as Palestine forever and ever. That's the mythology that was pushed back then. Now, when conscientious Jews, such as those at Jewish Voice for Peace, start speaking up and becoming very active, advocating totally nonviolent change, nonviolent application of strategies to implement peace and security and justice in Palestine. Again, totally in a nonviolent manner. We're still hearing from groups like Rabbi Eckstein's organization about how the thousands of Jews were killed and maimed by suicide bombers. Suicide bombers were acting out of the frustration of tens and tens of years of occupation to begin with. When they start taking nonviolent steps in the form of, as is mentioned here, women's groups, labor unions, and various activist advocacies, when they turn away from violence, none of these Zionists or Israelis seem to notice. They don't notice in a positive, reactive manner. Palestinians are turning, and have for some time now, been turning from violence, and it doesn't seem to change a damn thing. The situation just keeps getting worse and worse for the Arabs, for the Arabic-speaking Palestinians, Christian and Muslim, and others. Okay, that's what that is. We'll take a musical break, and then I'll have more to say about how Israel is messing up the peace process between Arab and Jew. Thank you. You have been listening to Music of the Oud, the instrumental predecessor to the European lute. Very large-bodied mandolin of sorts. Of the Greek tradition, the music you've heard is performed by a Greek-American artist whose name is, I haven't memorized it yet, it's rather strange even to my eye and tongue, Mr. Mavrothi T. Kontanis, whose concert I personally enjoyed in a cozy atmosphere a couple of weeks ago. Mavrothi Kontanis, Greek-American lad. But offhand, I would say there are some Arabic influences in both, not only in the instrument, but in the style. The style of playing. If anyone wants to enlighten us about the history or playing of the lute, of that whole tradition, give us a call here. Area code 831-427-3772. Again, that is 831-427-3772. The line direct to the studio here at Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, within the city of Santa Cruz, California. Also available around the world on our online radio service at www.freakradio.org. That's F-R-E-A-K, freakradio.org. Make sure you click on that red oval for the streaming service link. Also, if you are not inclined this particular moment to give me a call on the telly here, the telephono, just drop me a line at the email address for Mideast Migraines, which is MideastMadness@gmx.com. The email address for your one-way communication, although most likely I will respond, MideastMadness@gmx.com. G as in ghost, M as in Machiavellian, and X as in xenophobic, gmx.com, MideastMadness@gmx.com. Just reloading a page here, and good. That worked out well. Okay. I'm just taking a look at the details of on my magic box here of who all is listening to the show. Oh, this I love each and every one of you. Almost more than I can count. All right. As I said, one more quick note. I archive all the shows which I managed to successfully record, which is pretty much all of them these days. I archive the Mideast Migraine Show, formerly called Mideast Madness. Episodes under that title are available too in the archives, which is located at another website, namely radioforall.net. Go to radio, the number 4, ALL.NET, radioforall.net, to find shows at Mideast Madness or Mideast Migraines. And you can listen to them at your convenience wherever and whenever you want. All right. As I mentioned, I have more to say about the top 10 ways Israel derailed the peace talks, passed along to me by my friend David Schermerhorn. Good luck in finding him. He gleaned this from juancole.com. Blah, blah, slash, actually Israeli derailed. juancole.html. Juan Cole as in J-U-A-N-C-O-L-E. JuanCole.com. That's the partial identity of the individual provider, but this is also appears on informed comment. Informed comment. Top 10 ways in which it was actually the Israeli government that derailed the peace talks. By Juan Cole, April 7. Right-wing Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Sunday blamed the Palestinians for the collapse of peace negotiations that began last August under the auspices of Secretary of State, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry. In fact, the Palestinians took no Israeli land whatsoever since August, whereas the Israelis doubled their pace of building squatter settlements on Palestinian territory, territory over which they said they were negotiating. It is likely discussing with someone, sharing a piece of pie. I'm sorry. It is like discussing with someone, sharing a piece of pie, and then looking down and seeing that the other person has snarfed up half of it already. Here are the top 10 things Israel did to cause the negotiations to falter. And this one author is mine. Number one, even as it was agreeing to restart the talks with Palestine in August 2013, the Israeli government signaled its lack of seriousness. I wrote then, this is Juan Cole speaking and writing, I wrote then, quote, on the eve of resumption of peace talks between Israel and Palestine, the far-right Israeli nationalist government of Benjamin Netanyahu attempted to torpedo them with a series of provocative announcements. It announced that it would steal 100 acres of land from Palestinian families and build 240 housing units on it. The same government announced that it will grant 90 Israeli colonies on the Palestinian West Bank a special status, bringing them, quote, government grants, infrastructure investment, tax breaks, and other benefits, end quote. Bringing those grants, investment, tax breaks, and other benefits to Israeli colonies in the West Bank. The colonies receiving these perks included several that had been considered illegal even by the expansionist Netanyahu government until recently. Okay, number two. On August 11, Housing and Construction Minister Yuri Ariel announced his intentions to publish tenders for 1,187 new Israeli homes in the Palestinian West Bank. Minister Ariel said at the time, "We will continue to build, so it is clear that this is just the start. This tune can't be stopped." End quote. Now that would be reassuring to the Palestinian side, wouldn't it? That's what's written here. Again, reading from the top 10 ways in which it was actually the Israeli government that derailed the peace talks, appearing on informed consent. Number three, in November, Israel announced plans to build 20,000 Israeli squatter settlements on Palestinian territory. Number four, Israel doubled its pace of building illegal squatter settlements on the West Bank in 2013 over 2012. 2,534 new housing units versus 1,133 in 2012. President Obama remarked of this vast land theft, quote, "We have seen more aggressive settlement construction over the last couple of years than we've seen in a very long time. If Palestinians come to believe that the possibility of a continuous sovereign Palestinian state is no longer within reach, then our ability to manage the international fallout is going to be limited." End quote from President Obama. Number five. In early January 2014, Netanyahu abruptly began demanding that the Palestinians recognize Israel as a quote-unquote Jewish state as part of any peace deal. I suspect that this demand was a stealth way of getting prior implicit agreement by the Palestinian government to Avigdor Lieberman's plan to strip over 1 million Palestinian Israelis of their Israeli citizenship and render them stateless. In any case, it is a weird demand to make of another country. I pointed out that it is as though the U.S. began demanding that other countries recognize it, the U.S., as a, quote, white state or a, quote, Christian state, given the non-religious character of the current Israeli government on the whole, likely white state is the appropriate analogy. The Palestinians pointed out that they had recognized Israel within 1949 borders in the Oslo Peace Accords in return for Israel returning to them 100% of the West Bank and Gaza. Israel got that enormous concession for free, since it reneged on virtually all the obligations it undertook in the Oslo Accords and did not, in fact, withdraw from any of the West Bank at all. Number 6. In January 2014, the Netanyahu government released tenders for, quote, the construction of 600 housing units in the Ramat Shlomo neighborhood of Jerusalem, which lies over the Green Line, in other words, into Palestinian territory, and a further 801 units in settlement blocks in the West Bank in Palestinian territory, end quote. Number 7. On January 14, Israeli Defense Minister Moshe Yaalon attacked Secretary of State Kerry's efforts to secure a negotiated peace, accusing him of having a, quote, quoting Defense Minister Moshe Yaalon, messianic obsession. He said that the American plan for security arrangements was not worth the paper it was printed on, and added, and I quote, Secretary of State John Kerry, who arrived here determined and who operates from an incomprehensible obsession and a sense of messianism, can't teach me anything about the conflict with the Palestinians, end of quotation, when a senior member of the cabinet in the government of one of the two parties, let me start again. When a senior member of the cabinet in the government of one of the two parties to a negotiation admits such complete disdain for the negotiator, it isn't a positive sign. It is not a positive sign. Yaalon concluded, the only thing that might save us is if John Kerry wins the Nobel Prize and he leaves us be. End quote. By let us be, Yaalon meant, let us go on swallowing up Palestinian territory and kicking Palestinians out of their homes. Number 8. In early February 2014, Netanyahu government members slammed Kerry as an anti-Semitic bigot, slammed Netanyahu for allegedly following under his influence, and one member of the cabinet actually led a 2,000-strong prayer protest with rabbis pleading with Yahweh, their name for God, the Almighty, to remove Mr. Kerry's Rasputin-like hold over the Israeli Prime Minister. I, Juan Cole, wrote at the time, Economy Minister Naftali Bennett slammed Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu as being under Kerry's influence when Netanyahu was said to be considering leaving Israeli squatters on Palestinian land under the authority of the Palestine government in a peace deal leading to Israel relinquishing its current annexation project. Naftali Bennett is from the small religious Jewish Home Party that is in coalition with the largely secular or non-religious, non-theological Netanyahu government. Jewish Home is dead set against returning to pre-1967 borders or allowing the emergence of a Palestinian state, and has been threatening to withdraw from the government if Netanyahu signs a Kerry-brokered peace treaty with the Palestinians. Now, Israeli parliament member Moti Yogev, also from the Jewish Home Party, has attacked Kerry, this time as bigoted against Jews. He, Yogev, said, "Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is acting under Kerry's obsessive pressure, which may have anti-Semitic undertones. Kerry is not here to reach a compromise. He wants to decrease the Jewish presence in the land of Israel and create a Palestinian state," end quote. Yogev himself lives in an Israeli squatter settlement on Palestinian territory. Israeli Housing Minister Uriel Ariel, of the same party, Jewish Home, led a protest of some 2,000 on Thursday, with rabbis praying that Netanyahu will stand firm against Kerry. From a Palestinian point of view, the Americans more or less channeled Israeli proposals, so hearing the Israelis denounce their own talking points as anti-Semitic wouldn't exactly inspire Palestinian confidence, says Mr. Cole here. Number 9, the 9th top 10 way in which it was actually the Israeli government that derailed the peace talks. Number 9, on March 10, 2014, far-right-wing Housing and Construction Minister Yuri Ariel approved 839 new housing units in the town of Ariel. That you heard me correctly. Housing and Construction Minister Mr. Yuri Ariel approved 839 new housing units in Ariel on occupied Palestinian territory. That was last month. In addition, and I quote, some 31 housing units will be built in Almog in the northern Dead Sea. Additional 350 housing units are planned to be built in Rahel, north of Ramallah, end quote. Almog and Rahel are in the Palestinian West Bank. On March 20, 2014, as well, quote, the Jerusalem Local Planning Committee just approved the construction of 184 new housing units beyond the Green Line, which is to say, on Palestinian territory, at a time Israel was supposedly negotiating to accept a state on Palestinian territory. Reason number 10, Israel in late March abruptly reneged on its agreement to release about 100 Palestinian prisoners put in jail before 1993, been in jail for well over 20 years, whom it had earlier agreed to release as part of the Oslo Peace Accords, but whom it had not in fact let go. The Israelis released three-quarters of the ones it had agreed to, but refused to let the last 25 or so go. It was this piece of bad faith, along with all the others above, that impelled Palestine President Mahmoud Abbas to sign the Geneva Convention of 1949 and other international instruments to which Israel objects. Why? End of dispatch, which appears on informed consent, written by Juan Cole. Juan Ricardo Cole is a public intellectual, prominent blogger and essayist, and the Richard P. Mitchell Collegiate Professor of History at the University of Michigan. All the fingers, clearly, are pointing to Israel. All the responsible, intelligent ones, anyway, are pointing to Israel in its conglomerate tradition of intransigence, renegation, and lying about about its sincerity in wishing to deal with the Palestinian Authority, with Palestine President Abbas, with the PLO. Its tradition of selectively ignoring previous statements of good faith by the PA or the PLO, and demanding even more, apparently as conditions, spoken or not spoken, for continued talks, like you must recognize Israel as an Israeli, as a Jewish state. The reason why Mr. Netanyahu is stepping forward with that particular demand, demanding that the PA recognize and qualify the characterization of the state of Israel as a Jewish state, is because non-Jews, some 20-25% of the Israeli population within Israel itself, are making noises. The non-Jewish Arabs, Muslims, Christians, and others are beginning to exert whatever degree of political freedom they have in addressing the inequalities within Israeli society of how Jews get priority for a number of things over those non-Jewish Arabs, and are showing solidarity with their Palestinian brethren in the occupied territories, East Jerusalem, and in the Gaza Strip. Mr. Netanyahu feels threatened by this, and instead of giving priority to powwowing with those aggrieved Arabs, Israeli Arabs, Palestinian Arabs, instead Mr. Netanyahu is deflecting attention off of that political movement and demanding that the PA recognize the exclusive Jewishness of the State of Israel, which the name Jewish State implies. How could it not? Sip of water there. Okay. You can still call me at area code 831-427-3772, area 831-427-3772. It is 4:31 p.m. on Monday, April 14, 2014, so you know the show is not a rerun or a replay or a refeed, if that jives with your personal time-space continuum. 4:31 p.m. No, I lied. It's 4:32 p.m. April 14, in the afternoon, of course. Mideast Migraines comes to you every Monday at 3 p.m., 3 in the afternoon, on Free Radio Santa Cruz at freakradio.org. Click on the red oval. Also at 101.3 FM, pretty much within the city bounds of the city of Santa Cruz, California. There is also the Saturday edition of the same-named Mideast Migraines show program, starting at 11 in the morning, 11 a.m., every Saturday. We are finishing up Max Blumenthal's book, released just some 7 months ago, entitled Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. Just because we're almost done doesn't mean you should ignore my reading of his book. We're getting toward the climactic ending here. Some really remarkable stuff has been covered. So that's what we're doing on Saturday, on the Saturday edition. Both shows are indeed separate programs under the same title. Always, pretty much, with me at the microphone. I do the occasional interview when I can make the interviews work. Almost had one going between California and Morocco, the country of Morocco in North Africa, in the Arab world there, with a gentleman who has lived in the West Bank and has experienced firsthand the iron hand of Israel's military occupiers seeing the destruction, wanton destruction and ruination of the lives of many while he was there. He was kicked out of Israel, most likely for political purposes, a kind of political non-prisoner, a political exile, if you will. He lives in Morocco now. I was going to interview him about 2 weeks ago, 2 weeks ago Saturday, and two weeks ago today, on the Monday program, and we were having technical difficulties, so I do apologize for not bringing that much-touted interview to you, but we're working on doing one in non-real time, recording it and replaying it for you, just as soon as I figure out the configuration for doing just that. Couple of fascinating pieces from two individuals, neither of whom is an Israeli, a Palestinian, nor a United States person. Australian Foreign Minister denounces Jewish lobby's influence. Talking about a Jewish lobby in the halls of whatever they call their capital building in Sydney, Australia, down under, just about exactly on the other side of the world from where I'm sitting. Okay, what can that possibly be about? Former Australian foreign minister denounces the Jewish lobby's, quote, extraordinary influence. This from, if you think this is just some bogus Arab-based propaganda, this is an article that appears in Israel's most popular publication, Haaretz. It's periodical, Haaretz. Former Australian foreign minister denounces Jewish lobby's extraordinary influence. In a new book, Bob Carr claims the office of former Australian PM Julia Gillard was effectively held hostage by the Jewish lobby. Haaretz, April 10. Former Australian Foreign Minister Bob Carr, author of the book, has suggested that Prime Minister Julia Gillard's dogged support of Israel was due to the, quote, subcontracting of Australian foreign policy to Jewish donors, The Guardian reported on Wednesday. Again, this information is carried on Israel's own Haaretz. In his upcoming book, Diary of a Foreign Minister, Carr claims the quote, extreme right wing, pro-Israel lobby in Melbourne wielded, quote, extraordinary influence on Gillard. The book includes private text messages between the two, published without Gillard's consent, which detailed the pair's disagreement on Australia's support, or lack thereof, for the November 2012 United Nations vote concerning Palestinian observer status. In an interview with the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, their ABC, to promote his new book, Carr claimed the pro-Israel lobby in Melbourne, and wanting to not confuse anyone, I said Sydney earlier, that of course I was incorrectly referring to Sydney as the capital. It is not the capital. Sydney is Australia's largest city, I think. The other best candidate for largest city would be Melbourne, the political capital of Australia, to the best of my still knowingness, is Canberra, Australia. I don't know why Mr. Carr keeps referring to, or why Haaretz keeps referring to Melbourne here. Perhaps that is kind of a secondary political government or something. Anyway, I digress. In an interview with the Australian Broadcasting Corporation to promote his his new book, Carr claimed the pro-Israel lobby in Melbourne. The lobby in Melbourne. So something definitely political about that. Wielded, and I quote, extraordinary influence on Gillard and her office, negatively interfering with Australian foreign policy. Quote, I found it very frustrating that we couldn't issue, for example, a routine expression of concern about the spread of Israeli settlements on the West Bank. Great blocks of housing for Israeli citizens going up on land that everyone regards as part of the future Palestinian state, if there is to be a two-state solution. Mark Leibler, National Chairman of the Australia-Israel and Jewish Affairs Council, passionately rejected Carr's portrayal of the Jewish lobby's disproportionate influence. Quote, just unpick for a moment what he's saying. Let's talk about the Jewish lobby. He's talking about a difference of opinion between him and the Prime Minister, Lieber told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. Why can't they have a difference of opinion on a matter related to Israeli policy? He asks. How does the Jewish lobby control the Prime Minister? Lieber goes on asking. Through donations to the ALP, which of course would be the whatever that is, the ALP, and sending people to Israel? I mean, give me a break. Would anyone seriously accept that? Julia Gillard is an independent thinking woman. She can come to her own conclusions without being influenced by the Jewish lobby. End quote. According to the Sydney Morning Herald, Carr describes Yuval Rotem, Israel's former ambassador to Australia, as, quote, the cunning Yuval, and Avigdor Lieberman as, quote, gloomy and taciturn in his book. He also dubs the pro-Israel caucus within Australia's Labour Party, including notable Jewish members of Parliament, Mark Dreyfus and Michael Danby, as the, quote-unquote, falafel faction. Carr apparently uses that language. Like Leiber, Danby described Carr's accusations as laughable, adding that, in the current climate, it's okay to be a bigot. Carr responded harshly to Danby's accusations, calling the comments extraordinary. For years, I was president. This is author of the book, Bob Carr, speaking here. For years, I was president of Labor Friends of Israel. I wrote a book entitled My Reading Life, in which I recommend the book of an Auschwitz survivor, Auschwitz death camp survivor, as the most important book of the last 100 years, Carr told ABC Radio, thereby deflecting accusations of bigotry. My only point about Israel was that settlement activity ought to stop and that the Palestinian status, the increased status in the General Assembly, ought to be not blocked by Israel. So that's a position that the foreign minister of every European country would endorse, and indeed doesn't fall too much short of the foreign policy position of U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, said author Bob Carr. So even Australia gets into the ball game here. Or an Australian does, with his impressions. Here's the other item by a non-Israeli, non-Palestinian, Arab, non-American. I may or may not have read this. Yeah, I did read it last week. I'm going to read it again anyway, since we're talking about comments on the Middle East situation from around the world. Statement by Archbishop Emeritus Desmond Tutu on U.S. efforts to curb freedom of speech. 2 April. I'm writing today to express grave concern about a wave of legislative measures in the United States aimed at punishing and intimidating those who speak their conscience and challenge the human rights violations endured by the Palestinian people in legislatures in Maryland, New York, Illinois, Florida, and even the United States Congress. Bills have been proposed that would either bar funding to academic associations or seek to malign those who have taken a stand against the Israeli occupation of Palestine. These legislative efforts are in response to a growing international initiative, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, or BDS movement, of which I, Desmond Tutu, have long been a supporter. The BDS movement emanates from a call for justice put out by the Palestinian people themselves. It is a Palestinian-led, international, nonviolent movement that seeks to force the Israeli government to comply with international law in respect to its treatment of the Palestinian people. I have supported this movement because it exerts pressure without violence on the state of Israel to create lasting peace for the citizens of Israel and the citizens of Palestine, peace which most citizens crave. I have witnessed the systematic violence against and the humiliation of Palestinian men, women, and children by members of the Israeli security forces. Their humiliation and pain is all too familiar to us South Africans. In South Africa, we could not have achieved our democracy without the help of people around the world through the use of nonviolent means, such as boycotts and divestment, encouraged their governments and other corporate actors to reverse decades-long support for the apartheid regime. My conscience compels me to stand with the Palestinians as they seek to use the same tactics of nonviolence to further their efforts to end the oppression associated with the Israeli occupation. The legislations being proposed in the United States would have made participation in a movement like the one that ended apartheid in South Africa extremely difficult. I am also deeply troubled by the rhetoric associated with the promulgation of these bills, which I understand in the instance of Maryland, the state of Maryland, included testimony comparing the boycott to the actions of the Nazis in Germany. The Nazi Holocaust, which resulted in the extermination of millions of Jews, is a crime of monstrous proportions. To imply that it is in any way comparable to a nonviolent initiative diminishes the horrific nature of that genocidal and tragic era in our world history. Very wise man, Mr. Tutu. Whether used in South Africa, the U.S. South, or India, boycotts have resulted in a transformative change that not only brought freedom and justice to the victims, but also peace and reconciliation for the oppressors. I strongly oppose any piece of legislation meant to punish or deter individuals from pursuing the transformative aspiration. And I remain forever hopeful that, like the nonviolent efforts that have preceded it, the BDS movement will ultimately become a catalyst for honest peace and reconciliation for all our brothers and sisters, both Palestinian and Israeli, in the Holy Land. This statement by Archbishop Emeritus Desmond Tutu was issued by Oryx Media. And by the way, brought to us by the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. My goodness, it's already 4:48. Well, time does fly by so quickly, I will not have time to play you another installment of the National Summit for the reassessment of the U.S.-Israel special relationship, which was held at the National Press Club a month or two ago. We will not be playing that. How long is this next one here? Can I do it in 6.5 minutes? Ooh, I'll be racing through it. I'm going to hold off on this one. It's too long. We've got 6 minutes left. If I can find it quickly enough, I can do a bit of fun here. I'll do Bill Maher's commentary a couple of weeks ago. Bill Maher's excellent commentary on income equality. Mr. Maher, of course, was host of the ever-popular, outrageous, and totally controversial, politically incorrect incorrect program on more or less late night broadcast television. That came under fire because he said things that upset certain people a little too much. The program eventually dissolved, and Politically Incorrect evolved into Real Time with Bill Maher on cable HBO TV. Here is his excellent commentary on income equality. If it'll just let me fire it up here. Here we go. Let's try this.
And finally, new rule. Someone must tell me, what is with this new trend of people who have all the power acting like they're the oppressed ones? Heterosexual Christians under siege from gays. White people complaining that reverse racists are trying to strip them of their right to shoot unarmed black men. And most bizarre, the recent wave of billionaires sobbing that they're being demonized and under attack. And the thing is, it's not just having all the money in the world that's getting them down. It's that the rest of us don't often enough look at them and say, you are the most brilliant, industrious person on earth. Can you teach us how to be more like you while we buff your cock with this fine chamois? You know, I used to think Hollywood egos were the neediest, but these masters of the universe, more like babies on a plane. Stock trader Steve Schwartzman, net worth $8 billion, once said that Obama raising his taxes 3% felt like when Hitler invaded Poland. Sounds like something Sarah Palin would tweet after huffing paint thinner. But with the super rich, it's becoming a meme. Now we have Tom Perkins, net worth $8 billion, saying the richest 1% are so persecuted in America, they feel like Jews in Nazi Germany. Wow. Which is why, just to be safe, last week Tom built a panic room inside his mansion that's a full-size replica of Anne Frank's house. Is it really that hard out there for a pimp with $8 billion? You know, even when your shady financial tricks tanked the economy, nothing happened to any of you. Nobody went to jail. Nobody went broke. Justin Bieber didn't even egg your house. You just got richer while everybody else got poorer. The Oxfam committee released a report this year on global inequality, and the 85 richest people, 85, own more than the bottom 3.5 billion put together, which is half the planet. This is a real problem, and not just for when they go halvesies on a wedding present. And not that that Nazi Jew analogy deserves to be taken seriously, but the Jews didn't do anything to deserve the hate they got. But America's super rich? In the last 30 years, even though worker productivity went up 90%, income only went up 8%. If I was working twice as hard and someone else was reaping almost all the rewards.
Today is Monday, April 14th.
And I'd also want to know, how could that happen? Well, billionaire Sam Zell knows the answer to that. He said the rest of America should stop bitching about the 1% and realize they are the 1% because they work harder. Okay, now we do need to come after you with pitchfork. Is talking on the phone in a comfortable office really more degrading than working in a slaughterhouse or a sweatshop or on a reality TV show? With just one real estate deal last year, Sam Zell made 1,000 times what this guy makes. Did he really work 1,000 times harder? By the way, that's a coal miner, not John Boehner. Did you know that during World War II, FDR actually proposed a cap on income that, in today's dollars, would mean that no person could ever take home more than about $300,000? Okay, that is a little low. But wouldn't it be great if there... It'd be great if there were Democrats out there like that now who would say to billionaires, oh, you're crying? We'll give you something to cry about. You don't want a minimum wage? How about we not only have a minimum wage, we have a maximum wage? That is not a new idea. James Madison, who wrote our Constitution, said, government should prevent an immoderate accumulation of riches. Washington, Jefferson, Hamilton, they all agreed that too much money in the hands of too few would destroy democracy. What can you buy with $2 billion that you can't buy with one? You couldn't spend that kind of cash if you lived forever and your money manager was MC Hammer. And you know, there are some billionaires today who get that. And that's why they give most of their money away. As Warren Buffett once said, I should write a book on how to get by on $500 million because apparently there's a lot of people who don't know how to do it. Okay, that's our show. We're off next week.
And I am off as well. This is Ren Tawil reporting my findings from the world at large. By way of the Mideast Migraine Show, I'll be back, of course, next Monday afternoon at 3 o'clock Pacific Daylight Time. Don't forget the reading, closing readings, the next two or three Saturdays, Saturday editions of Mideast Migraines at 11 a.m., 11 in the morning to 1 in the afternoon every Saturday. Mideast Migraines coming to you thanks to the existence and persistence of Free Radio Santa Cruz, an ongoing expression of communicable civil disobedience. Wrap your mind about that. Here at 101.3 FM, streaming live at freakradio.org. Thanks for watching. Palestine Today is up next.